Hey, this is Mike Klassen, and welcome to Vancouver Overcast, a podcast where we have conversations with city leaders and innovators. I would like to thank listeners and subscribers for returning to the podcast after an unanticipated break. The episode that follows was recorded on March 8th, just days before a global pandemic was declared. They were anxious times, and the emerging health crisis made producing a podcast neither possible nor appropriate under the circumstances. 8 months later, it is my pleasure, therefore, to finally release Episode 10, The Lost Tapes, an interview with broadcasting legends J.B. Shane and John Tanner. And now, it's time for Vancouver Overcast. So welcome to the latest episode of Vancouver Overcast. It is my amazing pleasure to have two people sitting beside me here in the studio to talk about radio, talk about TV, talk about culture, talk about music. Two amazing people who had so much to do with the sound of Vancouver for so many years and were an inspiration to me at many times in my life. When I was a young guy, I used to watch them on TV and thought, how did they get away with that kind of stuff? and then, of course, we ended up doing some work together a few years later. So it's my great pleasure here to welcome John Tanner and J.B. Shane. Gentlemen, welcome, and thank you very much for taking part of your Sunday out with us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Michael.
So I guess we have a lot of ground to cover here, but I'm going to see where we go with this conversation. Jay, you, I think, probably got into the radio business before John, or did you guys get in roughly the same time?
I started up in Kamloops, B.C., and there was a guy up there who was the town hero. And I remember one time, we went for Chinese food, and he stopped the car at one point, and he told me, "You'll never make it in Vancouver radio." Where is he today?
I don't suppose we need to mention that person's name, but
Keith Hunt.
So in spite of Keith's lack of confidence, shall we call it, right, you very quickly found your way. And did you not do a TV program in relation to that? And was it based in Kamloops or was it?
Actually, yeah. I forgot all about it. I'm glad you brought that up. I was the host, believe it or not, of a dance party show.
Nice.
Well, not really. No. I was the host of a dance party show. And it reminded me of SCTV, you know, when they would do things. And one time I decided to cool myself off down at Riverside Park, but I forgot about something. Rivers have currents.
The Thompson River? Is that the one?
The Thompson River. So I thought, okay, move with it and you'll get on the other side. Well, that was not to be. A lifeguard came out and dragged me back, and I thanked him for it. But that was quite funny, actually. He pulled me back in, and I thanked him, and we got on.
John, you were also in pop radio at that time, top 40 radio, as they called it. What do you remember about that time in the, I guess it was probably the mid-60s?
I started in doing a high school show on CKOV in Kelowna in 1959 and 60, and then sort of got a job there working after school and weekends till I graduated in 62. But then I hung around the station, got a job, and worked there till 64. And of course, I'm DXing on the radio listening to Kobe in San Francisco, and I'm hearing a Buddy Clyde Hatton, who then ends up at CKWX in Vancouver, because we could hear WX at night and CFUN too on the skip. I mean, it just skipped across the mountains. So at night, you tune in your little transistor.
Buddy Clyde Hatton was gay.
Two, just two. The magic number two.
That's it.
Anyway, yeah, so I'm listening to all this stuff in States and Vancouver, and I want to work in Vancouver radio, CFON. Of course, I tuned into a guy called Buzz Lebo at the time.
No Buzz.
Got to meet. And he was just crazy guy. And he, so I spent four and a half years doing radio, sort of, but it was all kinds of radio. I had a country show. I had a jazz show. I had a rock show. I played tapes. I had CBC newscasts and back and forth on the network. So it was a lot of learning radio in the old days, right? Spinning 45s and 78s and stuff like that, and commercials on discs and on tape, reel-to-reel tape. So there was, yeah, lots of practice. So, but Red Robinson hired me to come to CFON in 64, and then I got to be a real DJ in Vancouver with Fred Lachimo and Tom Peacock and Al Jordan and Ed Carl and Red Robinson and so many interesting people over the years, yeah. But 67 was a cutoff. They changed their format, so I bopped over to LGAM. Mm-hmm. And a year later, we started doing FM at the same time, and that's when the hippie revolution started. But it was 66 and 67, while I was still at CFON, and CFON wouldn't play Country Joe on the Fish because it was, you know, marijuana music kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I would get visits from guys on Fourth Avenue from the psychedelic shop, and Doug Hawthorne, who is a big proponent of the music, and the Country Joe would drop by, and he had a Country Joe music, and I'd play it in the library, and, oh, this is great, but I can't play it on the air because I'm controlled by the top 40, right? But anyway, right, that's right. When it was all happening. 66, and then 67, the summer love in Vancouver was crazy, you know, because there'd been a BN the year before, and there was just like, he's everywhere. And I lived two blocks from the radio station, and it took me 15 minutes to walk there because there was traffic jams up Maple, up Cypress, all along 4th. Every street was clogged with people just wanting to see the hippies.
Those were the days, my friend. I thought they'd never end.
Yeah, that was, well, like you say, kind of ground zero for that, and probably in the whole country in some ways.
And Joel, that was Fred Lachimo. We went over to his house, and he put on Axis Bold as Love when we had a puff.
That's right.
Legal substance. Imagine hearing Hendrix for the first time. Oh my God.
And Dr. Amazing. John the Night Tripper, Grigri Gumbo, yeah.
Then I ran into Shane when we got to CKLG FM, because I was on AM, and John Runge over in FM there playing Montavani, and you were doing shows on the weekend starting in, what, 65?
Right. Yeah. About that,
Wow.
Yeah.
The thing is that that's all lost on us now. We're all about YouTube channels and podcasts and you know, Instagram and TikTok and all these other sort of social media platforms. But back then, you needed an antenna. You needed staff to kind of, you know, like guys like Ed Jurak to figure out how to jerry-rig those things to make them work. And
Ed could do anything. And he was also on the air, and he was really good. He had an incredible sense of humor. And he saved the life of a girl on the downtown east side. As was the case quite often with Ed back in the day, he would go for Chinese food out on East Hastings. Found a girl standing there. She said, "Can I sit in your car?" He said, "Yes." She said, "I don't really have any place to go." Ed took her back to the apartment. And he did save that life.
Yeah.
She turned her life around. I mean, her daughter is now with the L.A. Philharmonic.
I want to just, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. I wrote a piece for Vancouver Courier early last year after I learned about Ed Jurak passing. I did not tell that story. I had a hard time figuring out a way to tell it. And if you can imagine for the listeners what Ed was like, he was about 300 pounds. He was heavy. He had a sort of almost a cherubic face. You mentioned his great sense of humor. You wouldn't know it sometimes because he was so gosh darn earnest, right? But he would be downright hilarious when he needed to be.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds a little bit creepy, right? Because he's a fully grown man. But the truth is, he did exactly what you said. He took care of this person who had a child, and that child grew up, and I gather the woman herself was able to get off the street because he intervened at that time.
That's exactly it.
He did it in a very kind way that I think, sadly, that story probably may, you know, it'll be here on the podcast for a little while, but not a lot of people know that about Ed. But you guys did have very long careers in radio and eventually on television. And it's so interesting about what you guys did is how incredibly innovative it was. You guys were pioneers in many ways, but you also got a start in very mainstream, very button-down type of roles. Jay, how did you end up creating a bunch of these characters that had so many different names? Raul Casablanca, Captain Midnight, Chuck Steak, and J.B. Shane as well. I mean, were they like characters for you? Were you?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
What were you trying to do? Do you think on those all-night shifts, you know, what were you trying to do with those characters? You feel like you were an actor in that role?
Yeah, I do. I do. Again, go back to what Red Robinson said, that you're not a disc jockey. You're an actor playing a disc jockey.
So you guys eventually made your way into the world of FM radio, which is probably more suitable at that time, but you were in the FM world and the whole change of sound of music, the underground music, I guess they called it at that time. Did you find that that was something that was more your calling at the time? And obviously, you don't remember playing pop music as much as they would like to have played The Doors or something.
Well, we played The Doors, and I saw The Doors, and Led Zeppelin as well, and had the opportunity to go down to Seattle, and there was a big Skookum-like festival there. Arrived there, and Charles Lloyd was playing. Then Ike and Tina Turner came on, and they were incredible.
Is that the Seattle Pop Festival, Joel?
Yeah.
There were some good acts on that.
Oh, there was. Does anybody remember Lee Michaels?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Heidi High.
And then Led Zeppelin and The Doors were there as well.
So when you guys were in Vancouver and on the FM scene, I know that things started to change really quickly. It certainly grew in popularity. You know, to that time, a lot of top 40 radio was really paying the bills for a lot of those stations. FM was almost like a lost leader. And then all of a sudden, it became a really popular medium. People started tuning into FM, enjoying the kind of music that it was playing. And you guys formed some of the voices that were on air at the time. What do you remember about those kind of early days, John, of FM radio in the 1970s,
well,
I guess?
Even 1967. I mean, I remember, as JB has told us here, over in FM they were playing Montavani, but then John Runge, who was just across a big studio from me at the same time I was doing an AM show, and he'd come over and, John, can I borrow that album of The Doors so I can play the long version on FM because it's on an album. So he would sneak that in on his show. This is in 67. Maybe Bill Ryder had been doing some blues on FM, but that was the only progressive stuff that was going on. So that happened in the 68. Suddenly they started playing The Doors and all the other things, the Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, all the underground stuff, Lou Reed, and when Lou came to town, The Doors came to town, Jimi Hendrix. Oh, music was just amazing at the time. And that's when JB came over and did the voices. He would record the Chuck Steak voice for Daryl B. and Roy Hennessy in the morning. A lot of those were on tape. Those were just your voice,
right,
and they'd play with the voice on the tape.
Yeah.
It was beautiful, and it sounded like he was there live. Well, he had been just an hour or so before, but it was all pre-recorded. What's Chuck Steak doing now, JB?
Drinking again. Just drinking more and more and more. Hear me? Where, Michael, is he? Where's the bar?
You know, it's such an incredible time to be creative. You just don't see that really in the radio space anymore, that kind of channeling of characters. And also, you talk a little bit about some of the music you guys used to play. I mean, you would be required to play from a certain playlist, but that didn't always happen. You probably did some deep cuts on records that you didn't, or even played records that some people hadn't heard of before.
What I used to do is I had a friend, Jack Nortman, who was a radio junkie.
Yeah, Jack.
And what I had him do is play the long, long version and then have another turntable set up with something else. And I would leave for a while and go up and have a cream cheese and lox and bagel at a place that is no longer, and then come back. God. And by that time, I was ready to take over again.
Yeah, did you ever, I know that's what they say, that the famous breaks that would happen when you played the whole side of an album or something, because they did that in the wee hours.
Oh, yeah, you could put album sides on and stuff. I mean, FM, AM was controlled. You had to play all the music from your top 40. Eventually, they put it on cartridge. But in FM, you had those 100 albums that you could choose from. Yeah. Jazz, folk, blues, all kinds of rock. And it was just amazing. Spoken word. Cheech and Chong were happening. It was wild, yeah.
Tommy Chong, where are you?
So
he's out there. He's close by.
So sadly, in retrospect, there came a point, and I think the dates are correct on this one, about 1975, there was a labor dispute at one of the radio stations. Unthinkable at this time, because it always has been really a non-unionized environment, but you guys were involved in, somebody was trying to organize there. And in the end, I guess the station owner ended up firing everybody, all the on-air staff, and it left you guys kind of without jobs at that point.
Well, that all started at CKVN. I'm not going to mention names of people who were involved in this, but there were people who were organizing at the time. And then by the time we got over to back to LG, because that's when CKVN changed their format in 73, thereabouts, LGFM again. And I got fired over a freaky license plates thing that we won't go into right now, but that was back in 69. But at this point in 74, the same people were still trying to organize. So then they moved over to LG because there was a regime on where disco was coming in.
That's
they were changing
right.
the format. They yep. had a guy from, and again, no names, but this person is still alive. And we get along, but, you know, they were hired to be the programmer, and that at CKVN they changed the format, and then the same person came over to LG and changed the format there and made us play the disco, and it was really embarrassing, you know, having to do that for us, because we were more purists for the music and we wanted to stick to the heavy stuff. So there you go,
Disco 75.
There you go. But it all evolved into a strike through, it should have been through a different, it should have been the same union as the CBC is involved
in. It should not have been.
Not QP.
Not QP. Yeah. It should have been ACTRA.
Yeah, ACTRA. So there you go. We made a bad choice, but everybody was so annoyed with the big changes. And
incredible, eh?
It was really a heavy regime. So we can't blame management. They were trying to change the format to make money to keep up with the times. And we were caught up in that. And the strike ended. I came back from my honeymoon in 75. The strike was over after we'd been out there in February in the snow. And it was horrible weather.
I kind of wonder if... I think it came out in about 1978. There's a movie called FM, which is probably a little bit hard to watch these days, but it had some great artists and great music in it at the time. And it was very much a story like the one that you just described. I mean, I remember reading something about that movie years ago, that they changed the ending and put more of a happy ending on it where the DJs won. And in fact, the original story, I gather, the DJs all kind of, you know, got the boot. And so you guys were, it sounds like that was all what you experienced with later,
kind of
dramatized later on.
That's right, because the strike was on. I went out on my honeymoon. I got back. The strike had been settled. Everything was happy. We got our, you know, we got our union in the station for the first time. But within 1 year, they had gotten rid of everyone who had been involved with the union. They mm-hmm. decertified it, and JB and myself and Bob Nest were called into their office
right.
and fired all on the same day, and we were the last of the union troublemakers, and off we went into the blue. So you can see how that led to others, station work and night dreams, because we were so frustrated, and the punk scene was happening. So in 76, we started that.
Incredible when you think about it. In 76, 77, that's when things started to really change with music. Yeah. And let's face it, at the time, the music was very good, but it was changing. There was a, there total was an changes, energy yes. happening. There were
Sex Pistols, The Clash were happening. You know, all of this was going on in the UK, and the punk scene here, we got the DOA, the Pointed Sticks. We got the Subhumans. We've got the Young Canadians, K-Tells originally, you know, Art Bergman, all those great people. And then we had Suzanne Tabata at CITR, who joined us on Night Dreams in around 79, 80, you know. So we evolved from 76 to 83. Shane Lunny taking over later and pre-recording the show. So it wasn't live at the end, but we get out with Ed Jurak out there, and he was wearing my Jalava, you know, he was running around and we're doing all these skits and things. So yeah, it was just...
It was, for me, it was daring. And the fact is, it started with you basically playing records, just spinning platters.
That's
and
right.
then you had the you had the little mirror ball, and you used to kind of play with the camera.
The little alien was there, and Mr. Tasty was our producer, Don Fraser. Yeah, and JB came in. I did it by myself for a while. Then I got JB to come in on the show, and then we got Suzanne eventually, and then you got Devorah on there, and JB would do these skits with Devorah, and he'd come in and he'd have Jeff Franklin there painting and putting up posters and made part of the studio look like a back alley. And there the JD was sitting there like he was drunk with the garbage cans. And it looked like it were a real scene with Devorah. And then it would go into a Lou Reed song that started with the same scape. You were in a back alley and it just flowed like that. And you produced the most incredible skits just out of your head. Just all happened. Just magically, that show. We were there for a couple hours before and it was all produced. And then we did it live for an hour and a half. Sometimes,
crazy. And what are we talking about now? Night Vision or
Night Dreams?
Night Dreams.
Okay, so after
there's a lot of nights.
Yeah, so after Night Dreams ended in '83, after Shane had rebroadcast and did shows that we pre-recorded, not so much live. Then the show folded. There was no money. And, of course, then Much Music started. And we were so annoyed because we never got into the scene because we were right in it. And then it just ended because we were, this is Cable 10. We're volunteering. There's no money except for gas to get there and for props. Thanks to all the record companies, Columbia, RCA, A&M, all of those people, Polydor. We'd visit Monica Leputsky in the weekend or Frank Gigliotti or whoever it was. They'd have piles of old VHS videos there and some half-inch tapes of all these artists, but they were so hard to get hold of. But every couple of weeks we'd make the trip around and pick up all these videos and haul them into the studio, and it's just a wild scene. But then when that ended, you went on with a show on Super Channel, right, called Night Vision, correct?
Night Vision.
Super Channel,
Super Channel. And that's when we actually had to pay extra on our cable bill to try and see that channel, which is people did it. You know, I don't think I ever did. I probably just did whatever my folks had at the time. Yeah,
I wish we had too, because some of the shows that are still on tape are just unbelievably hilarious. They're so funny. You had a cast of characters on there.
I did.
David Cubitt. He was. You discovered David Cubitt on
I
that
did.
Show.
David Cubitt, Jr. at the time, we had an audition process. I was going to play a teen idol with a, with a wig on. And the lines were like, "Hi, I'm Adrian, and on the weekends I like to go and wash, spoon, and dry my laundry. Won't you be my special laundromat date?" Well, my beautiful co-star, Devorah, said, take that wig off. Let's get a real teen idol in. And this is really what if. So we had a succession of actors and models come in, and one guy wasn't too bad, but had more of a surfer look. So I wanted somebody more generic, and David was the one.
There you go.
Janet Clark came running in. Are we going to let him go? Bring him in. And he read it. He got it. He chuckled at it, but he was the guy.
And you guys had so many great characters that would make appearances. Ed Jurak, of course, we're bringing him up again. He was, he seemed to have no fear when it came to, you would put a costume on him. You would put him into, he was, Leda Babushka? What was
Babushka.
Babushka.
Right.
And so he used to do these kind of Eisenstein type of black and white, and he would have the, the babushka wrapped around his face and tell these tragic stories with babushka.
We filmed that. We went outside and we filmed that out around UBC.
Yeah. There were other characters too. I think I have a copy somewhere laying around of. And again, this is pretty racy stuff. Goring wasn't boring, so you had him dressed up in like the Third Reich.
And
dancing around. A friend of mine once said that sort of music videos, he says, that's back when they were cool. It was when you guys were playing them on Night Dreams. Elvis Costello, in fact, in his early incarnation, ended up filming, I think, on probably 8mm or something like that on some old film stock. Down at Stanley Park, and those are the kinds of things that you were playing at the time, and then later, you know, we started to see more video productions and great bands like Bauhaus was a.
I saw them. Yeah,
you guys sort of ended up really kind of turning on this kind of alternative scene before even, you know, much music became a thing recorded out of Toronto, but that was all happening here in Vancouver at that time. So at some point, you know, you sort of jumped from show to show and these things ended up kind of winding down. And then along came Coast 800 in probably, I'm guessing, 1989, maybe?
That's right, 89, yeah.
Yeah.
I was working at the station at the time as a newsman because,
that was,
of course,
the one out in Langley, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was. I'd worked there before when it was a different call letters and Chesney was running it back in the 70s. But this time it was Coast Radio, Coast 800 Radio. And I did a news shift on the weekends because, you know, you got to stay alive, and I started reading news in Kelowna, so why not? Yeah, so it was an experience to be there, and then suddenly the word was, David Marsden was in town, and he was going to start a new radio station, and there was three in the category list of who it might be. There was CKLG, I don't remember the second one, and there was our station, Coast.
So tell us a little bit about David Marsden, because he was quite a guy from Toronto. He had created
CFTR, was it?
Yeah.
Yes. Was that the station, CFTR?
I'm not sure.
I believe that, because the thing was that they were in, were they out in Brampton or somewhere a suburb?
It was the Spirit of Radio inspired station, and I can't remember the call letters now, but it was the kind of the first alternative station that happened in Toronto.
The trip was, they weren't in downtown Toronto, but they had a transmitter, and he was the first one to get a transmitter on the CN Tower. Mm. So there they are in their station in the suburbs, broadcasting to all of Toronto, and it just blew people away. And so eventually David came out here to the West Coast, and he started it at 800 in Langley, and then it moved to downtown to 1040.
This is when I actually was a big fan of JB, so I kind of reached out to him, and he didn't know who I was, so I ended up coming out to Langley and met Marsden. And at the time, you guys were, you know, kind of doing the station there and playing really for an AM station based in Langley. You were playing the only kind of modern music of the time.
Yep.
And so people were, I think they were struggling to hear it. It didn't sound that great on AM.
That's right. It was hard to get in Vancouver, you know. Yeah.
Try getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Getting a taxi down to
I can't picture it, Jay. I still can't picture it.
I know.
You did the morning show. I don't know how you did that.
I don't know either.
You must have really wanted the job to get up there.
The music was so amazing. It was just all the new stuff, and grunge was starting to happen, and Nirvana was happening.
Well, I got into a little bit of a kerfuffle with Marsden when we moved downtown. That was a lot easier.
I'll just explain a little bit. So what happened was, there was a station with a better signal was 1040.
Yep.
And 1040, which everybody knows for the last many years, has been a sports station here in Vancouver.
Right.
But it has, and this is what Ed Jurak used to tell me, and I think even Marsden talked about it, had a much stronger signal. You can hear 1040 on a good day way down the coast. It's got a powerful, and it's because it's not interfered by other stations or something.
Right.
So what happened was, at that point, Marsden, maybe he felt sorry for me because I kept coming out to Langley, but he ended up giving me a gig of to try and help doing some stakeholder work to try and get the application. So they could, because you had to go to CRTC, you couldn't just kind of, you had to kind of, in order to move a license from one place on the dial to the other, you had to go through the government.
Right.
And so we needed to go and get, you know, hundreds of signatures and letters from all these different groups. And that was my job for a little while.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you did a great job.
I did a good job to get onto AM. But then what happened later on, the story goes, is that they tried to get the FM because they weren't satisfied with the 1040.
Right.
And that's where it kind of, you know, didn't go any further. Anyway, so that's just a little setup. So we're now downtown on Pender Street. You know, the station was really starting to grow a lot of big fans. I remember, I think I still have a copy of the Coast 1040 yearbook.
Yes. Yeah, wonderful book.
Do you remember, Jay, when Coast 1040, I think it was down at the Canada Place at the end, and they they had a live morning show.
Yeah.
And you had a bunch of rotating guests, and they had a whole audience there. I mean, like, that station built up a huge fan base at some point just because of the music and the sound.
Well, I remember walking into a Japanese restaurant and hearing two people talking. And one of them said, "Have you heard that guy on the radio on that particular station? He's really crazy." Funny, crazy.
Well, we had back then, and that's where I started to indulge you a bit more. And, yep. You gave me a nickname, and I guess because we are both cinephiles of sorts, and you probably go to more movies than I do these days, but back then, we were crazy for making sure we had the best seat at the Ridge Theater. And I don't know how you came about it, but you called me Kino.
Yeah.
K-I-N-O, which is cinema in German. He called me Kino Klassen, and that became my nickname. And right. So it became Shane and Kino, and we ended up doing, well, quite a bit of work together for a few years.
The Hollywood North Report was quite funny.
I thought so.
And we got calls from North Shore Studios. I did. And they said, "We don't know what the hell you people are doing, but we really like it."
So the whole cinema culture that was starting to happen here in Vancouver at that time, and of course, we had Alan Franey, who'd been running the film festival here for many years, and we started to create the Hollywood North Report. I really kind of took liberty with some of the characters, like Marty Eisler, which was Jack Norton, who played this kind of pushy LA producer type guy. he was raising money because he wanted to cut a swath of the North Shore mountainscape to put the Hollywood North sign.
Right.
I remember
and
that.
And then, I wrote a little bit around it where we were, because they had this, somebody, I remember who ran it, but they ended up losing their shirt. They created this event called Movie Magic, and it was taking place at BC Place Stadium. And so Movie Magic was going to be this great showcase where everybody could learn about the making of movies. Well, of course, nobody showed up to this thing. But I wrote this little piece where we were actually, to showcase the Hollywood North sign, they were going to move the letters of the Hollywood North and set them up inside BC Place. But what happened is that the letters were too big they wouldn't fit in the airlock. And as a result, the dome started to deflate. And they had punctured one of the airlocks. And I mean, people won't remember this perhaps, but
did you time it when it was deflated?
So it was well before that, but we would have a blast with just crazy ideas. And we do these little shtick. I would come in every Friday.
Yep.
And do you remember, I think his name was Craig Peters or somebody who was the...
Craig Peters, yes.
Yeah, he was the...
Production manager.
Manager, and I think, poor Craig, I would come in there with a script, and he would go, "Man, I've got to do all this production on this one little bit that you guys are doing." But he ended up doing a great job in some of them. They were just so much fun to listen to.
Yeah, Craig Peters is alive and well. He's a Facebook friend.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. Well,
hello, Craig. Thanks very much for all the great work you did back then.
Hi, Craig. What are you doing now?
So
he's with the LCB or whatever they call them now. He's
LCB?
With the Liquor Control Board. What? Who do they call that now?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Alcoholics.
Yeah.
No, he's not an alcoholic.
No. So those...
He plays golf.
So those were some of the more interesting kind of heady days of radio and kind of before we did start to see more of the kind of internet revolution that happened. I mean, when you guys look back on what you're doing there and you sort of see what's happening today, you have to probably say to yourself, you take a little bit of credit for the kind of spirit that we're seeing from do-it-yourselfers out there online.
Do you think, Michael, I ask you and I ask John, that Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed, not his best album, Berlin was, would that be played today on the radio? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No.
Hard to say. I mean, music has improved so much. I mean, there's so many good bands.
Well, these are newer bands. But do you want to, like, I go to the gym and they don't play music anymore because if they did, we would be confronted with, Justin and Beaver and Justin Timberlake. Hold on.
Well, there's a whole audience for a lot of music, but it's just fractured now. There's just so much. And there's the hip-hop thing, which has hardly been touched in this town, you know.
And I listen to some hip-hop, and people do not realize that our hip-hop fans, that where it really started was in the streets of New York with a group called the Persuasions, who would do something called street corner talking in New York. And that's where it really began.
You know, I think to be fair, I think of an artist today who has been so successful, Billie Eilish. Some of her sounds are kind of dark and mysterious, and she's a very young woman.
Yeah, she has a new album, I believe, too.
Well, she's got an EP.
But I'm trying to picture, and I think... Your point is that Walk on the Wild Side actually was on sort of top 40 radio at some point. It was, you know, it got played and it was a single. I think it would be a little bit harder to hear, you know, a song with a stand-up bass and talking about, you know, hanging around with hookers is it, you know, so explicitly in that way would be a little bit unusual, I think, given the environment for the music radio that we hear today.
You want to hear about Lou?
Oh, tell me your Lou Reed story. I know that you told me this many years ago, but I've forgotten much of it. So tell us.
Okay. What happened was, first of all, it was a holiday that day, and he was in the glam rock phase, right?
Right.
Though Walk on the Wild Side was a masterpiece, a better album was Berlin, which was slagged when it first came out. Happens. And so what we did, we being myself and Bob Ness, who was very open-minded, I played him some Roxy music, and he said, I like that. So we went over there, and we knocked on the door. Sound effect. And then Lou came to the door, and he saw we had a bottle of Johnny Walker Red. And he said, come in. And we sat down, and I made a little faux pas, because at that time John Cale and Lou Reed were not friendly with each other, but both musical geniuses. John Cale is still around. Like to see him again. Seen him many times. Lou was shorter than I thought. He looked a little pale, and he we talked for a while, and I said because. I shouldn't have, but I did. I said, what do you think of John Cale's Paris 1919? And he glared at me, and he said, what do you think of it? I just left it at that. He went to the window, and he said, oh, so this is where Izzy Opinza jumped from. Huh? And he was not unfriendly, but in between bouts of Johnny Walker Red, he would go into the next room, cocaine.
Lou was... I think he was pretty much a full-blown addict at that point in his life, and
He
struggled with that throughout a lot of his career. But
so, we talked, and then he would go into the other room and do some more, and then Ness left, and I was there with Lou. And what I will always remember is when we got in the elevator, he said, "Why don't you stay for dinner?" And I did. And he saw the promoters coming, and he said, keep them away from me, because he'd been ripped off so many times. Mm-hmm. He had all these bizarre... He had his fingers painted. This is glam rock, right? He had his fingers painted, and he had, like, some really bizarre rings on, you know, lots of them.
I know that Lou was definitely somebody that you revered and always admired his music and very much related to his music. I don't know, John, if you've any sort of rock encounters of your own that...
Well, no, I didn't carry a tape recorder with me at all times or have a camera or photographer nearby like Red Robinson used to do. And you see him with all the old greats, you know, Elvis, Buddy Holly and that. But I did a number of interviews have over the years. I mean, on Night Dreams, we had people in on the show. Probably one of the funniest interviews was one with a band called The Specials who were in town and they were live on the show and that, and I ended up getting Annabelle's dessert in my face. One of the Specials whacked me in the face with it instead of eating it like he was supposed to. Funny stuff like that. But I'm not kind of a person that's comfortable interviewing people, and a lot of times I'm very shy around artists, and so I tend not to sort of run up to them, and if we connect or something, that's good, you know. I used to like to go backstage and toke up with bands back in the late 60s through the 70s when they came to town, because we used to get to introduce all these bands. So there'd always be maybe the drummer or somebody in the band that liked to have a toke, so that was always fun. And through a lot of the bands, you get to meet people. But Fleetwood Mac was always fun. I got to know some of them well, and then I visited John McVie and Christine Perfect, or she was McVie at the time, at their little house in the country in England once. And I guess my biggest thrill was to be at a press conference with the Beatles in Seattle in 1966. There was a press conference there, and I got to see the show. I went down with my girlfriend, BJ, and her sister in Craig McCaw, and we saw the Beatles' second row center, their last tour ever, you know, when they were in Vancouver, or in Seattle. Unfortunately, they didn't play in Vancouver in 66. It was 64, right? Mm-hmm. Saw them then. It was an afternoon show, and then after the concert, we got to go in and go do the press conference thing. I was there with Mad Mel, a thing that was exciting for me at the time was I was going to meet Paul McCartney when we went backstage with Mel, because he knew them from Australian radio. I was dressed as the Jolly Green Giant at the time when I did the interview, and while we were waiting to go backstage, a photographer came over and said, "We want to get the band, the Ronettes, want to get a picture of you with wearing your outfit." Wow. So I posed with the Ronettes. If that picture is out there somewhere, I'd like to find it. I've been trying to track it down.
Wow. I love the Ronettes.
And meanwhile, Mel and Paul go backstage, and I missed out on that encounter. So I've never really met a Beatle in person, but they're one of my favorite groups next to Elvis, I guess, who started me off in rock and roll. But it was the business gets you to meet a lot of groups and interview bands and introduce bands. You know, I mean, Terry David Mulligan and I did introduce the Doors on stage when they played here on that infamous show where there was almost a riot at the end. When they stormed the...
Is that like 1970 or something?
Yeah, 70, yeah. I believe. Yeah, yeah, stormed the stage. So there's lots of fun stories. I'm trying to work on my memoirs.
Didn't John Lennon tell Red Robinson to get off the stage?
To F off the stage.
Actually. Right,
Well, that's because the manager, Brian Epstein, had asked Red, could you please go up and make an announcement that the boys won't play anymore unless the crowd moves back. And Red tried to do that, and Lennon didn't realize that his manager had asked Red to go up there. So
right.
Didn't help much. I think they missed two or three songs.
I'm sure for Red Robinson, that would be a badge of honor to this day.
Yeah, I mean, wow. Well, I mean, the guy got to introduce Elvis and was hanging out with him down at 57 before the concert, and he hung out with the Beatles backstage and stuff. So, yeah, being a DJ was fun, but you had to have a personality not only to be an actor on stage, but then you had to interact with these bands that you would meet and interview sometimes. My worst interview was with Joe Jackson. But
I remember that.
That was for Night Dreams, too, and it was just awful. It was just,
he's changed a lot.
I have to say, when I look back, you guys had great chemistry with the women that you invited on your shows. So Suzanne Tabata, Suzanne's an old friend of mine. She was, I mean, you could tell it was very cool what she brought to the show, what you guys did. I know that later, Devorah on Night Vision, the work you did there, you guys played off each other in such an amazing way. You got to play the kind of the macho man sometimes against her. And it was, I mean, you have to picture, you know, JB, he's not exactly, you know, I don't, none of us in this room can, you know, be in the George Clooney category, but, you know, you guys played against each other so well. And I know that later on, Jackie Underwood too was, always played so well against you. She loved to play characters. And
well, Jackie Underwood is the only non-Arabic person in Vancouver who has actually met Saddam Hussein.
Okay. Quite an honor.
No, they because she was a correspondent, she married a Palestinian gentleman named Joseph. He took her to Saudi Arabia. The family treated her very, very well. And being a correspondent, Radio Jeddah, they take, you know, they went down the Tigris, saw the castles, and then they walked into one bar someplace, and there he was. Saddam Hussein.
I'm assuming it was a hookah bar or something. not a place where they poured liquor.
No.
Can I get a word in here? Mr. Shane, I just want to say that you've been an inspiration to me back when I first met you, and I heard that you were Barry Shane in Kamloops, and then you showed up at LG, and I started getting into your crazy humor, and then actually working with you at CHRX, is another rock station that Bob Morris is programming there, and some great people we work with. Ellie O'Day worked there with us at CHRX. But
go ahead.
Yeah, so, but in the LG days, the LG FM days, you were always giving me, we go down to the beach, hang out at Jericho, wherever, and you would give me ideas. I'd have my notepad, and we'd be writing things down, little notes, and you'd give me one-liners. Every day he gave me one-liners.
I still write down a lot
and
of
I'd
stuff.
Use those in my show. Those are my one-liners. And I said, are you sure you don't mind if I use these? No, no. And he'd give me all these great ideas. And it was just like you were really an inspiration, and I thank you for that. You know, between you and Uncle Vern, my spiritual advisor, it was a great time to be alive, especially as the herb was happening.
The herb was happening.
Hey, John, I want to ask you, you got to be well known for your interests in the heavens, astronomy, astrology. You really incorporated that into a lot of your work, and I know that you've maintained that sort of active interest in, throughout your entire life. How did you kind of mix that into your work as a broadcaster?
Astronomy was my hobby, right? Astrology, not so much. Although astrology is interesting, it does go back to the early times. I was introduced as an astrologist on TV once in an interview about something going on in the skies. But yeah, so because of that, when I was working at LGFM, they were building the planetarium. So I hung out over there and where they were staying in the Maritime Museum, David Roger, and he was a DJ and a planetarium director from Edmonton. So we hit it off pretty well. And so I started working at the planetarium. I did the very first show there. And worked for 47 years. But
can you remember the first show?
Oh, yeah, I do, because I didn't know I was going to do it. It was supposed to be David Roger and H.R. McMillan, who was 93 at the time and had donated $1.5 million to build the place. He wanted David to be with him in the audience and hang out with him. And so David couldn't do the show, so I was the second in command to do it. But I wasn't prepared. Well, I was. I'd been rehearsing, but I didn't expect I'd have to do the first show. So it's kind of scary, you know, live with music background and running the star projector and other stuff. It was pretty, you were like a DJ, except you're playing 10 or 15 records at the same time with commercials.
No kidding. Yeah.
Okay, here we go. I had to steal, and I did, one night when the janitor with the big voice...
Larry the janitor.
Right. I had to sneak out the first Roxy Music album because they wouldn't know what to do with it. They finally got on board with For Your Pleasure and a few other things. And then, as John mentioned, you know, it became Disco 75, so that was the end of that. But the people that I have met, I have met Jimmy Page backstage. He had just purchased the house of Aleister Crowley.
There you go.
The Beast. And there was Robert Plant cradling a baby. And I talked to him for a while, and he was very, very cool. Still is.
You've seen it. You've seen it. You've done it. You've been there. You've been there at the forefront of, I guess, when heavy metal, as they called it back then, was coming on, and then you were a part of the alternative music and right. The punk scene and new wave and college alternative rock, and really kind of on the forefront of all that
We did a show. I agree with what John said at the time, that I was playing this character, my son, called Nimrod. In retrospect, I should not have done that, because it would have freed me up to do other different characters than that. Nimrod has his place, but it was too much. And
Nimrod was a character that JB did on my radio show I had at CITR. When I left Coast Radio in 93, 94, I got really depressed, and my wife said, "You've got to do a radio show." And
I remember that.
Go out to CITR. So I went out to CITR, and they have, if you want to do a show there, you just sign up and then you come to take the course and learn how to run the equipment. And if they okay you, then you go on the air. And I didn't say I'd worked in radio or anything. I just went out and a couple of people sort of recognized me and later said, "Hey, it's nice to have you here," whatever. But, you know, I was just me trying to do my thing. Along the way, in 2006, because this was about 96 that I started doing this, I asked JB to join me and do a show, and we had a show called Radio Radio, right. And then Son of Night Dreams. So about 3 or 4 years he worked with me, and we did a show together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was every other week. We did it for an hour and a half.
But in retrospect, I played like Nimrod, my son.
Which was his son, JB's son, so he couldn't be JB and do all those other characters and be himself, right?
Right.
So, and he got a bit cranky and was swearing and stuff at the end. And
But in retrospect, John is right. I should have not been Nimrod. I mean, he's got a little place there.
He was fun for a while, yeah.
For a while, but he was getting really negative, you know, and I thought, I
we've had enough.
And you've been an amazing number of characters over the years, probably 25 or 30 that I could probably start counting off.
How about Herb Foley?
Herb Foley with the garden report. Yes, we have the gardens. They're blooming. Look at all the beautiful flowers out there. Don't pick them.
There's some pussy willows.
I'm going to tell
pussy?
And the Dweezil sisters.
Oh, yes, the Dweezils.
Do you remember the Dweezils? We used to do these two voices, falsetto voices. I was Yogurt and you were Yutha. Dweezil. Yutha, what song are we going to sing today?
We're not going to sing anything today, John.
No?
No.
Why not, Yutha?
Because I can't sing anymore.
Oh, silly girl. Yogurt.
Jay, do you remember, I have this is a Coast 1040 story, so we're going to kind of bouncing around the timeline. I guess as the station was starting to kind of come to its end, they were cutting back. So I think they had somebody who was doing nights, and eventually they pulled them, and then they voice tracked you.
Right?
And now you were doing mornings, and they decided to voice track you. And so somebody who would be listening would be hearing JB on it, you know, 1 a.m, and then he'd be doing live radio at 8 a.m. So it didn't make sense. So you decided He did a character.
Yeah.
And you ended up doing David Hawk's son.
Right.
He likes doing people's sons.
Dino Hawks.
Dino Hawks.
That's right.
Now,
David Hawks, who's to a lot of us, and he's now involved with a Hollywood theater reopening. Right. David Hawks was a longtime music DJ, worked down at Love Affair, and he ended up having a weekend show. And was doing
at
evenings.
LG,
but he was at
Coast at the Fox,
for,
rather.
He was at Coast for a while. So, so what? so he didn't have any children at the time,
right?
Right. And, oh, and so right. you created his son,
oh, right.
Dino, and you did the whole, all the voice tracks for that they would play. And
right.
and apparently people would come up to Dave and say, I didn't know you had a kid. Yeah. And he got starting to get really mad at you about that.
Yeah, his girlfriend said, wait a minute, where's the son come from? Yeah.
I had an argument with, I like Dave Marsden. He got me back into radio.
Yeah.
But I had an argument with him. I said, look, we're playing all this alternative music. A lot of it is from Toronto, like the 77s. Who are they? They don't know them out here. Why are we not playing the most important figure in alternative music? Why don't we play some Lou Reed? And he said, oh, he's too depressing.
He can be at times.
Yeah, that's true.
So you guys, I guess, you know, to kind of roll things out, I wish we had more ways that we could document some of the work that you guys did over the years. And I know that if you do a little bit of searching on YouTube, I've uploaded a few things that I was able to keep and save. But to me, that's part of one of the things that I find most disappointing is we're so great at archiving a lot of all of this old fantastic creative media that we once had, but a lot of that stuff right now is lost. So to kind of hear at least a few in the past hour, some of the anecdotes of what you guys did, and hopefully I get to create some interest through this podcast to have a few more people to kind of maybe start asking some questions. What was going on back there? What were we doing? I mean, there's a lot of reverence for the old radio stars, but it was also more than that. It was really being on the leading edge of some very exciting culture happening at the time.
Well, thanks to Suzanne Tabata, who got all of the old Night Dreams stuff that Don Fraser, Mr. Tasty, saved. And we've got a number of shows, maybe half a dozen at most, of Night Dreams shows. But that's it. You know, I used to tape stuff in VHS, but it got erased and it just disappeared. And people keep saying, hey, I've got a bunch of Night Dreams stuff on my VHS. I'll have to look it up sometime. So if anybody is out there that has any old material from the early days, we'd love to see it for sure.
Jay, I'm guessing you have a show that you wish we could all see again.
That would be Night Vision.
There was a guy who had the tapes and they went missing, right?
He took them back to Toronto and we never saw them again.
Sadly, I know the story that happened there because I actually had access. They were all 3/4-inch videotape masters,
right?
That had all the shows on them. And they were in a cardboard box, and I guess they got stored in a place where they got water damaged. And so we ended up losing a lot of that incredible. So there are clips available. I've got a few that I've saved.
I've got some VHS ones.
Yeah. But that, again, that kind of work, losing that kind of incredibly funny work that should be someplace archive for people in the future to see.
I wish it was. There were so many funny things. I mean, some of those skits that JB used to do were just classic things, you know, and only a small portion is still there. But anyway, it's out there in space somewhere. Maybe some other civilization is picking it up and saying, what
bring
the
it back. Bring it back. All is forgiven.
So I want to thank you guys both very much for, again, coming out. It's a nice day, but you could have been doing something else. But I'm very honored to have you come here and tell some of the stories and share them here on the podcast. And you know what? Like I say, I think both of you had so much to do with really creating part of what Vancouver culture is and has become. And I want to make sure that people always recognize what you guys did back in the day on radio and TV and all these other media as well.
I'm just thrilled that I was part of radio during the golden age, because back when we spun those 45s and LPs, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And thank you, all you listeners who've been there all these years.
Hello, listeners.
You're listening to Vancouver Overcast. My guests have been J.B. Shane, John Tanner, lots of stories to tell, and a lot of credit goes to them for some incredible broadcasting that was done over the years. And thank them both for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Mike.